For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Father, we know that we're not going to get every question answered, not just in this teaching, but in our whole lives. There's so many things about the way you work that are beyond us, but that doesn't mean we just put our brain on a shelf and try not to think about how hard life can be. You want to give us answers, ways of responding to what we face that can really help because you love us. And I pray that this perspective that you're going to share here through these passages we look at, I pray it would help us just get a better grip on why you've set things up the way you have. Amen. Yeah, so the problem of evil, it is a big deal. So I might as well start off with something rough. This is rough. This is a lynching in Marion, Indiana, in 1930. About 2,000 people have died this way over the years. 75% of them are African Americans. And if you look at the faces in the crowd there, there's laughter. There's this guy in the center pointing at one of the victims. That's menacing. He's saying, "This could be you. Take note." And so you see stuff like this, obviously horrific. And horrific that people are just kind of milling around like nothing's wrong. And it just makes you do. You wonder, how can there be a good God? How is that even possible that a good God could just passively stand by while this goes on? I mean, couldn't he make the rope break? Or just intervene? Couldn't he enlighten some of these people so they get a grip on what's right and wrong? Why does he just have to let this roll by over and over and over again in many different ways throughout history? You know, this is the crux of the argument. The argument says the fact that evil exists suggests that God doesn't. And it is formidable. There are a lot of people, I think, that might entertain pursuing a relationship with God if they could get over this. This is not a, you know, people aren't just blowing steam when they object at this. It's formidable. And I think if we're going to go out into the world, into the marketplace of ideas, trying to tell people about what we believe, we better be able to at least give a reasonable response to this objection if we hope to profess Christ in an intellectual and honest, responsible way. We just can't turn the page and try not to think about this. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to get into it. Now, I want to start out with the logical problem of evil. Let me just say up front, I'm not a philosopher, and this is not a philosophy class. There's no way we're going to cover everything that we need to cover. I am a mathematician, though, and fortunately, a lot of these logical arguments are framed in mathematical terms. Like, if this premise is true, then this premise is true, then this conclusion follows. Probably the best known logical construction, logical argument that's out there is called the deductive argument. It goes something like this. Premise one, only one team wins the Super Bowl every year. Premise two, the Browns are terrible. Conclusion, the Browns won't win the Super Bowl. Now, I might have it off a little, but you get the basic gist. That's how these deductive ideas, that's how they work. Well, a lot of the, in the middle of the 20th century, and for years before that, this argument has been used to eliminate the possibility of the biblical God existing. Probably the guy that's most famous for putting this forth is a guy named J.L. Mackey. And he wrote a book called God, not a book, he actually wrote a journal article, and the title escapes me now. I think it's God and Omnipotence, I think something like that. Anyhow, he says that there are three logically inconsistent claims. three things that cannot all be true at the same time. God is all powerful. God is all good. And there is actually evil. He's saying you can't hold all three of these views simultaneously. Now think about it. He says, this is how he puts it. There seems to be a contradiction between these three propositions, so that if any two of them were true, the third would be false. Okay, so for example, if God were all-powerful and is wholly good, wouldn't he prevent evil? Of course he would. But there is evil. So either he's limited in his power or he's truly not good. You ever heard people use this line of reasoning? This is, you know, you're talking to somebody over a beer at a bar. This is what people bring up, and this is the guy that helped formulate it. You know, and this is rough. He goes on. He doesn't just stop here. He makes a very strong case. You can't have all three of these things being true at the same time. And then to drive his point home, he says, at the same time, all three are essential parts of most theological positions. You know, if we could just defeat one of these premises, right? If we could just show one of them to be wrong, if we could just do that, the whole thing falls apart. But unfortunately, we Christians sitting in this room, we affirm every one of them. You know, think about it. God is powerful. I'm not going to show you a ton of verses on this. This is clearly taught in the Bible. God is what's called omnipotent. He's all powerful, able to do anything. God is also good. It's not a controversial doctrine in the Bible. That's a repeated emphasis. And according to the Bible and in your own experience, undeniably, there is evil. And yet they all can't exist. And what does that mean? The God of the Bible, an all-powerful, all-good God, can't exist. So there you have it, the problem of evil. We lose, he wins. Next week, we'll talk about prophecy of the Bible. You know, a lot of people feel like that pretty much does it for Christianity. But there is a weakness, fortunately, with this argument, and it's at the very end of this quote. He says, it seems at once the theologian must and cannot consistently adhere to all three. Okay, so Mackey's saying you can't hold all three. And that means if we could show, no, actually, there's a plausible scenario where all three of these could be true, if we could demonstrate in some world, in some logical situation, you could have all three happening at the same time, then this would all fall apart. Okay, and think about this. Another way to put it is, what if God had a suitable reason to allow evil? What if a good God, an all-powerful God, also had a suitable reason to allow evil? Well, in a scenario like that, all three could be true. Now all we need is an actual real-life scenario where that's the case. And fortunately, we're living in it, okay? We'll get into that in a second. Now, enter Alvin Plantinga. He just looks like he's going to jump up and get you. Look at that guy. Also a philosopher. An eminent, very well-respected philosopher. He carefully wrote a defense of the Christian worldview, a defense of the idea that a good, all-powerful God could allow evil. It's called the free will defense. It came out in his book, God, Freedom, and Evil. This was in 1974. And this was a philosophical bombshell. We're still feeling the reverberations of this today. J.L. Mackey himself admitted in 1982 that Plantinga successfully refuted his deductive argument against God. So this, you know, you may have these God's good, God's all-powerful, what about evil talks around a bar with a buddy, but in philosophical circles, that deductive article has been dismissed and it's been dismissed because of the work of Alvin Plantinga. And so what Plantinga did is he posed the question, what if a world with creatures free to choose is intrinsically more valuable than a world without freedom? What about that? What if just by its own nature, a world with free choice is better than a world where there's no free choice? And what if free creatures in that world, not God, but the free creatures themselves, choose to do evil? That's kind of the heart of his argument. And he posits, that's what he posits. If we could construct a world like that, we could have all three of these premises being true at the same time. And like I was about to say a bit ago, that's the world we live in. We live in a world made by an all-powerful, all-good God who had reasons to give us free will, knowing the possible consequences. Let's kind of walk through this. In the Bible, it says that God created man in his image. Not that we look just like him. It's not like God has opposable thumbs and we do too or something like that. We're patterned after God. And a big aspect of the way we're made in God's image, we talked about this last week, is our personhood. Human beings have the capacity to be aware that they exist, to be aware that other people exist, to be able to interact with them and express themselves. Humans show evidence of things like religion, morals, art, a longing for purpose and meaning. These are all things that are part of what it means to be a human being, part of what it means to be made in the image of God. And one very important thing God gave us, also a part of his image, is the ability to choose. We have free will. We can move into our environment and make decisions that affect it for good or for evil. That's part of the way God has built every one of us. That's part of the dignity we have as persons, is we're actually able to freely choose to love or to hate, to engage or disengage. That's part of the way God thinks has set things up. And that means, because we have free will and the option to exercise it, we can choose to bring evil into existence. That's one implication of this. We can, by the decisions we make, by choosing to go against God and kind of strike out and do our own thing, we could actually bring evil into existence. And we've seen examples of that all through history. We did. That's kind of our story. All the way back to Adam and Eve in the garden, who decided to throw off God's rule and to kind of strike out and do their own thing. We've got examples of human beings rejecting God's guidance and leadership and purposing to do what they want, even if what they want is hurtful and destructive. And so we get this thing that happens to all of us, not just individually, but to the human race. I don't know if you've ever talked to someone that you knew as a little kid, and then you saw them decades later after a lifetime of bad choices. And you can just see how much they've changed for the worse. You ever had that experience? You just meet someone, you haven't seen them in years, they've had a rough life, and you're like, wow, you've been broken in two over the last 30 years. Well, something like that happened with humans. You know, we saw last week in Genesis 1, God made the world good, good, good. That's a repeated refrain. But despite how good the world is, it has been marred and corrupted by human sin. And that leaves us with this really weird paradox. We're image bearers, broken and destroyed by sin. So on the one hand, we see this great acts of kindness and love. That's part of what we see. But on the other hand, we see unspeakable evil. Both. You guys ever see Gettysburg, the movie? One of the central characters in that movie is Colonel Joshua Chamberlain. He's a Civil War colonel. And he tells a story. It's in the book, too, that the movie's based on. He tells a story when he was with his dad. He was quoting some lines from Hamlet. And this is what he told his dad. He said, this is the line he quoted. What a piece of work is man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty and action, how like an angel. So his dad's listening to this, and he retorts, well, boy, if he's an angel, he sure's a murdering angel. Killer angels. That's what we are. Made in the image of God, capable, because we're image bearers of free will, and guilty of using it to bring evil, great evil, into this world. This is the biblical worldview. This is what we see here. And of course, you know, after that first decision from Adam and Eve, this propensity to choose against God just had devastated consequences. You throw off God, a being that you were designed to know, that you were designed to function, you know, walk with side by side, who alone gives us meaning and purpose. You cut him out of your life, and you'll be left with a vacuum that drives you to find what you need wherever you can. And that drive pushed people to do all kinds of things to get what they want from each other, out of life, out of the environment. And it led to a mess. We're going to study the book of Genesis later this month. We're going to go through the first 11 chapters, and you'll see these decisions to sin kind of spread like shower mold all through humanity, just relentlessly spreading. And it works a couple ways. Human free choice, we can look back now and we know it is the direct cause of most evil and suffering in the world. It is. I mean, you think about molestation, violent assault, famine, needless famine caused by warfare and greed, stuff like that. So much of the suffering we see the responsibility rests right at our doorstep. Humans responsible for mistreating each other. That's a big part of the evil that we see. And you know, the rest of it is the indirect cause of evil. Because according to the Bible, when Adam and Eve sinned, they brought sin into the world. And when that happened, it corrupted everything. Not just us, but the natural order. If you read in Romans 8, verses 20 and 21, it says that the creation is groaning, that it's longing for the day when it's going to be restored, because right now it's corrupted. And that's why we see things like, you know, genetic defects, or, you know, just horrific diseases like cystic fibrosis, or, you know, other things, other tragedies, what we would call natural tragedies. They're not the direct result of somebody sinning. Jesus makes that clear. Read John 9, 1 through 3. Those things, those kind of, you know, natural tragedies like that, they're not a result of direct human sin. But the Bible, it teaches they are the indirect result of that original decision that Adam and Eve made. All right. So who's to blame for this? Who is to blame? You know, let's think about an axe real quick. An axe is a useful tool. I've got one. I've used it periodically. Axes are great. They can be used to do great things, to free somebody from a burning building. And they can be used in a bad way too. Yeah. I don't want to leave that picture up there too long. It's pretty menacing. Now, who's at fault? The axe or the wielder? Let's think about freedom. Freedom is just freedom. It can be used to do great good, or it can be used to do great evil. Freedom isn't the problem. It's what free-choosing agents did with it. When they chose to exercise their freedom, that brought evil into the world. So who's to blame? The Bible would say free-choosing people like us are to blame for evil. Now, I know at this point, this is where everyone's like, yeah, wait a minute. And so I wanted to try to anticipate a couple questions here. You'll have an opportunity, but if you're new here, we'll throw it open, and you can grab a microphone afterwards and ask a question if you want. But let me try to anticipate a few. First, couldn't God override free will to prevent the most heinous evil? Why couldn't, what about a sniper shot to the head while Hitler's driving around in his car? Why couldn't have God stepped in and, like, removed the gas from the gas chambers? You know, done something to just prevent some of the worst kinds of evil. I mean, come on. He's totally able to do that. Well, the problem with this has to do with what freedom is. Freedom is F-R-E-E, free, right? We can do what we want, and that means we're allowed to affect the world that we're in. Here's another way to put it. If you truly let someone choose, you let their decisions have real consequences, right? To not do that, what is that? A lot of times we would call that enabling somebody. Right, you want to give someone freedom, you need to let them go and let them have the effect that they're going to have. That's what real freedom is. Couldn't God create a free will being who would never choose to do anything evil? This is a hot topic right now in philosophical circles. Can't we have somebody who can pick what color shirt they're going to wear, but not have the option to go, like, you know, machine gun 53 people? What about that? Give them free will, but within some constraints. I think when we say that, what we're asking for really, we're not asking for this. What we're asking for is a logical contradiction. We're asking God to make a square circle or to microwave a bean burrito so hot he can't eat it or whatever it is. If you want this, you want a logical contradiction. And if you want a logical contradiction, why are we using logic to try to reason away the existence of God? This you can't have it both ways. Free choosing agents can't be controlled. What about this? Wasn't it irresponsible? This is the one that messes me up, honestly. Wasn't it irresponsible for God to make free will creatures with such power for good and evil? I mean, would you give a toddler a chainsaw? Are we responsible enough to handle free will? God knew. God knew how he built us. What about that? I almost would like to throw the mic open because I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. What about that? Is it irresponsible? Well, I think this is where I've landed. Let's think about the alternative. Let's think about a world where free will doesn't exist and what that would cost. You guys ever seen Blade Runner? I got to quit using almost 40-year-old movie references. But I just love this movie. That's J.F. Sebastian in the middle there with Daryl Hannah. He's a robot maker. And that's his robots. And when he rolls in after a long day at work, they say, "Hello, how was your day?" Like recording a message to yourself that you just play on recorder every time you come home. God could have done that. God could have programmed us to react and respond to our natural environment in pre-programmed ways, but he did not want that. It's not what he wanted. God knew a better world involved free will. God knew that you take away choosing and you take away personhood. You take away the ability to love, to move towards someone, to freely choose to enter a relationship. You take away free will and you have something, but you don't have what you could possibly have if you retained it. And so God said, with all the costs and aware of all of it, he said, a world with free will is better. Okay, and then what? What happens? You know, as God's watching the shower mold spread and he's watching the kind of the slow motion train wreck that is human history, what does he do to respond? Well, this is a key part of it too. You got to take all of this into account as you weigh out this issue. He respected our choice. What an awesome moment And God's like, okay, go for it. That's the way the Bible describes it. He says, even though they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give him thanks, but they became futile in their speculations. Their foolish heart was darkened. Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. He let us go. Isn't it true with a lot of us, we've had to do this? We've realized there's only one way to reach this person that I care about, and that's to take my hands off the wheel and let them go. And that's what God did. God took this response. It's kind of like the plot of Home Alone. You know, at the beginning of the movie, he's like, I want nothing to do with my family. And then at the end of the movie, that's all he wants for Christmas. God's hoping, as he gives us enough rope to kind of do our own thing, and we have to live with the reality of what it's like to reject him, that we'll wake up and come to our senses and turn back to him again. Now, it wasn't just this. That would be kind of heartless if he's just like, that's it. While he took his hands off and said, go for it, he also made a plan to rescue those who would turn back to him. And this is a key piece. This plan involved God entering the world of sin and evil in the person of Jesus, actually living among us, you know, trying to serve us, being maligned, misunderstood, falsely accused, unjustly treated, beaten, and then brutally executed on the cross for a reason. So that instead of us bearing the burden for the evil we've done, the weight of the guilt that we have, he took all of that off our shoulders, put it squarely on his own. That's what his going to the cross was about. Because he did that, we can turn to him freely. And you got to remember, he values free will. And so he freely chooses to do this. Nobody twisted his arms like, you got to do this. Jesus is adamant as he reflects on his decision to enter our world and to die for us. This is what he says. He says, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I chose this. I moved towards you. And so you, as an image bearer, as somebody who's made in God's image, free to choose, are invited to do the same and choose God. That's what's on the table. That's the way this is all constructed. You, person you are, image bearer that you are, you can choose your way back to God. You know, when I was really, I don't know how old I was, old enough to know better, I was camping with my dad, and I climbed this cliff face, and it was made out of that real crumbly shale that you'll see on stream banks around here. Super dangerous, super stupid. You know, like Alex Honnold, the guy that climbed, what is it, El Capitan, he was smart enough to know climb on granite. So I'm on this shale cliff face. I mean, literally, it's crumbling as I'm up there. My dad walks up quietly so he doesn't startle me. And it hit me just what a dangerous situation I'd gotten myself in. And I looked down at him and I thought, I sure would like to be standing next to my father right now. But, you know, I was there. Fortunately, obviously, I survived. But, you know, that's where you're at. You may feel like you've gotten yourself in kind of a pickle, and you may be worried there's no way out. And there is a way out. You can choose right now to tell God, I want to go back. I want to know you. So there's that. Now, just take that all in. Mackey's deductive argument, answered by Plantica's free will defense, which needs a scenario, and that scenario is the world we live in, and it's been spun out as we've looked at what the Bible says. This is why we say, and we can say this with some pretty good philosophical backing, that the God we worship, a good God who is all-powerful, isn't incompatible with the existence of evil. Now, I've been kind of backpedaling, like, okay, yeah, okay, okay, kind of on the defense all the way through. And I'd like to take a different direction. What's your answer? What's your answer to this problem? It's not just a Christian problem, it's everybody's problem. Every single worldview has to answer for the existence of evil. We all do, all of us. Let's think about pantheism for a second. You know, in pantheism, this world is all that is, and this world is God. Think about that lynching scene. In pantheism, the perpetrators are God. The victims are God. The rope and the tree it hangs from, it's all God. God is all. It's all in balance. And our sense of distinctions, you know, between good and evil, things like that, that's illusory. That's the pantheistic worldview. You have a strong sense of guilt or a strong sense of gratitude for forgiveness. Those are distinctions in a world that really, the world before your eyes isn't even there. It's illusory. This is Kobayashi Isa, Japanese poet, one of the most famous poets. He's a Buddhist. And he went through a series of tragedies where he had lost a boy after, I guess, a couple weeks into it, after his son was born, his son passed away. 2.5 years later, he lost one of his daughters. And so he was devastated and went to a kind of a Buddhist mentor for some help. And when he talked to the mentor said, "The world is due." That was the response. The solution to this is to realize this world is an illusion. And so Isa went back to his house, and in the midst of his grief, he wrote this poem. And there it is. What do you guys think? Yeah, pretty good. What a great poem. Now, it's a haiku. You're probably familiar with this format. The dewdrop world, he said. This dewdrop world is a dewdrop world. And yet. What's he saying? He's saying, when I held my daughter in my arms, when I saw my son die, that wasn't due. That was real. The loss I feel is because I was in contact with something and it's gone. That's what he's expressing. Saying this was just an illusion, good and evil, tragedy and joy, unsatisfactory. What about atheism? Atheism, yeah, you know, we could say a lot about this, but here's the heart of it for me. Atheists can't define evil. On what basis could we call something good or evil? That's a real problem for atheism. This is Richard Dawkins, one of the world's leading or best known atheists. And I gotta say, I'm not a big fan of him, but I do respect how honest he is about the implications of atheism in this quote. Check him out. He says, "The universe that we observe is precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." That's right. You know, when we see a human being, you know, rescue someone or do some other act of courage, or we see them, you know, being treacherous and malevolent and deceitful, there's no ought to that. There's no that's the way it should or shouldn't be. It's just is. We're just part of the natural environment. You know, I used to have a beagle named Buddy. And one day he brought a dead baby rabbit to me. He crushed it in his jaws. He's like, "Here's a present for you, a dead rabbit." You know, he just dropped it right in front of me. And I, you know what I didn't do when that happened? I didn't call the police. I wasn't like, "There's been a murder in my backyard." I didn't do that. I didn't do that because that's just natural, you know. Beagles eat rabbits. That's just the way it is. And according to this worldview, there's nothing chiseled on stone orbiting the earth that says when a human being mistreats another human being, It's evil. There is no higher court to appeal to. There's just time and chance and energy and matter, and that's it. You know, Oz Guinness, in his book, The Dust of Death, he makes this observation, and he's right. He says, from several different viewpoints, it's been cogently argued that modern totalitarianism is closely connected to the death of God and the loss of moral absolutes. And I'll tell you, that's true. We've never seen more people killed ever in the history of the world than we did during the 20th century. And not by coincidence, we saw the emergence of godless, atheistic, totalitarian regimes. I'm not saying, you know, we've got it all figured out, but there's a connection between jettisoning God and encouraging an outburst of evil. When you think kind of nature is it, listen to Hitler. He says, I can't understand why man should not be just as cruel as nature. I can't either if there is no God. And so, you know, we talk about, you know, the problem of evil. Atheism has a big problem with evil, a real big problem. So, yeah, I know some of us, you know, if you're here and you don't believe in God, I know that there are arguments out there that we can find a way to talk about good and evil. But I would argue, if you're not into God, if you don't believe in God, and you want to hold on to the concept of good and evil, you should hear this guy out. This is Ravi Zacharias. He says, when you say there's evil, aren't you admitting there's good? When you accept the existence of goodness, you must affirm a moral law on the basis of which to differentiate between good and evil. Hear what he's saying? If you're going to talk about good and evil, there's got to be some standard, some law that says it's good and evil. And then he says, but when you admit to a moral law, you have to posit a moral lawgiver. That, however, is who you're trying to disprove and not prove. For if there's no moral lawgiver, there is no moral law. Isn't it ironic? We often use the existence of evil to reason away God, and yet our very desire to talk about it leads us right back to his doorstep. We have to have God to have the ability to talk about good and evil. All right, pretty grim. Let's move on and just a couple final thoughts here. There is reason for hope. I realize some of you are in incredible suffering right now. You've been mistreated or you've had unexpected loss. And you don't want to hear a logical argument against the problem of evil. You just are in pain, and I get that. And I think one thing, it'd be really screwy to do this whole teaching and not just say, God's able to personally comfort you when you're in the midst of pain. I'm not saying you're going to palpably feel it, but I'm also not saying you won't palpably feel it. My wife and I have had a couple curveballs over the years. I can remember one really tragic situation. We were sitting in a hospital room grieving the loss of what would have been our first son. And I remember palpably feeling comforted. We prayed together, and you could just sense that God was in the room. Now, I'm not saying that happens every time we suffer, but I am saying God is alive and God cares. I'm also saying you can be certain he understands. He lived in this world that we live in. He knows what it's like to be rejected. He knows what it's like to lose people that he cares about. It's not some trite thing God can understand. He went to great lengths to really be able to understand. This is John Stott. Now, this is a long quote, but it's worth every bit of your attention. So let's check this out. He says, I myself could never believe in God if it were not for the cross. In the real world of pain, how could one worship a God who was immune to it? I've entered many Buddhist temples and stood respectfully before the statue of the Buddha, his legs crossed, arms folded, eyes closed, the ghost of a smile around his mouth, a remote look on his face, detached from the agonies of the world. But each time, after a while, I've had to turn away. And in my imagination, I've turned instead to that lonely, twisted, tortured figure on the cross, nails through his hands and feet, back lacerated, limbs wrenched, brow bleeding, mouth dry and intolerably thirsty, plunged in God-forsaken darkness. That's the God for me. He laid aside his immunity to pain. He entered our world of flesh and blood, tears, and death. He suffered loss for us. Our sufferings become more manageable in light of his. There's still a question mark against human suffering, but over it we boldly stamp another mark, the cross, which symbolizes divine suffering. Think one of the worst things about suffering and confronting evil is how alone we feel. But you're not alone. The living God exists, and he does understand. And that's important to hold on to that. Here's another one. The day is coming when he's going to defeat evil. This is a silver maple. This is a dirty, evil tree. I've got one of these in my backyard, literally all year long. In the winter, it drops sticks. In the spring, it drops these little fuzzball things. I don't even know what they are. But then it drops propellers. Then it drops leaves. And it just repeats over and over. And its roots are shallow, and they may mess up drain tiles. I mean, this thing is malevolent. It's evil. And when I get the money, the one in my backyard is going to go down. I'm taking it out. I'm going to pay somebody, eliminate it. I can get excited about thinking about that. Now, if you read Isaiah 25, Isaiah also gets excited about God moving in judgment. He's rejoicing in it. That God would move in judgment against wicked people. And it might seem strange that he's so positive about something that seems so negative, but he explains why he's excited. He says, God, when you do this, when you move in judgment against the wicked, you're a defense for the helpless, a defense for the needy in his distress. You know, when we think about judgment, part of what we don't like is we're thinking about how it affects the person being judged. But what about the person that's being oppressed? When the oppressor is removed, the oppressed is set free. You know, I had a first grade teacher who was fired for being cruel. No joke. The first half of the year, she like smack us, lift us up by the ears. I mean, she was bad. And she was fired. And I feel bad about that. I'm sure that was very difficult for her. But you know what? Every kid in that classroom was liberated. I'll never forget the next day, she was gone. I was like, what? She's gone. So now listen, I'm not saying that as forgiven sinners who are worthy of judgment, no Christian should rejoice in thinking about any individual being judged. God help that. We don't want that. But it's okay to know that the day is coming when God will move in judgment. And molestation, you know, rape, genocide, and all these horrific things will be done for good. That's part of the hope that the Bible puts out. He's also willing to overlook the evil that we've done. Now, this is, you know, when we think about this whole topic, we tend to minimize what we've done and maximize the evil of other people. That is the reason why married couples fight. That's it. We minimize our own offenses. We maximize other people's offenses. But, you know, in a quiet moment, we know that we're culpable. We know we're guilty. And that troubles people. And it is troublesome. But you don't have to be troubled. God can deal with that problem for you. And he did. This is talking about what Jesus did on the cross again. It says, God made Christ, who never sinned, to be an offering for our sins so that we could be made right with God through Christ. You know, we all have guilt, but Jesus lifted that off his shoulders and took that on himself. He took what we were bearing and took the whole load on top of himself. That's what he did on the cross. And if you acknowledge that and ask that to apply to you, this problem will be dealt with, this problem of guilt in your life forever. That's how you become a Christian. That's how you're made right with God. One last thing. This is the very last thought. You know, a lot of us here know Bob Coleman. He's a guy in my home church, a friend of ours that we've had for a long time. And over the last, just last month, after a pretty long struggle, he succumbed to a very aggressive form of brain cancer. And it was brutal watching him go through this. You know what's crazy is when Paul talks about suffering like that in 2 Corinthians 4, he calls it momentary light affliction. And I got to be honest, as I watched what Bob went through, it didn't seem momentary or light. No way. I mean, he was declining over the course of a whole year. He was in excruciating pain. And his family and friends are going to be reeling from this loss for a long, long time. And so I don't want to be, you know, some kind of pious, oh, that wasn't a big deal. It was a big deal. We just have to remember that when Paul calls what we go through, the evil we face, momentary and light. When he does that, he's saying in light of the eternal weight of glory that we'll enjoy. Think about eternity for a second. This is all 2 billion years of earth history from your elbow to your fingertip. And that tiny red dot inside the red circle, that's human history. Kind of humbling. We're here for such a short time compared to the lifespan of the earth. We're here for such a short time compared to eternity. And I think part of the answer to this is as 1 trillion and 2 trillion and 3 trillion years roll on by, it's going to do something to what we've been through. It's going to change the way we see it. And it unbelievably will bring it to the point where it does seem like momentary light affliction in light of all that. I don't know what Bob's up to right now. He's probably planning a vacation to somewhere in the new heavens and new earth. If you know him, that would be the kind of thing he was doing. But I know this. He's experiencing things that the eye has never seen, that the ear hasn't heard. He's in a place we can't even imagine. And when we catch up with him, and we've been with him for a long time, that's going to be part of the answer to all this. I'll just leave you with this. Eternity, I think, is going to do something with the evil and suffering we face, something we can't comprehend right now. So, all right. There you go. Next week, we're going to come back and talk about prophecy and the Bible. I'm totally jazzed about this talk. We're going to get into some, not just what the Bible predictions that have been fulfilled, but how the Bible views the future and how that view of the future is coming to pass.
This study was recorded at Zenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.